DMT clears your system in about 15 minutes. If you take some compound, drug, or whatever, and 48 hours later, you're still taking hot baths and, wishing you could have a massage and sitting staring at the wall, then this drug is really sticking to your ribs. It means that your metabolic pathways have no way of dealing with it. They can't grab it here, they can't grab it there, and it takes a long time to leave your system. An example of this in the pseudo-psychedelic domain would be ketamine. You know, ketamine, the experience lasts about 45 minutes, but 48 hours later, you can feel your knees suddenly go rubbery, or you can have what are technically called fugue states, strange states of disconnectedness from what's going on around you. This is not a very good advertisement for a drug. Here, this woman, and then you.
I was just curious with the ayahuasca, how much you would take that and
the
things that experience?
Well, less, because if you smoke DMT, the dose is approximately 50 milligrams, which is like the size of a kitchen match head. If you combine it with an MAO inhibitor and take it orally, you can probably get away with about 35 milligrams of DMT, and 100 milligrams of Harmaline. Now, Harmaline itself is sometimes described as a psychedelic drug. I really think this is sort of misleading. You will have hallucinations if you take pure Harmaline, but only at doses approaching the toxic dose. Many compounds will give you hallucinations approaching the toxic dose. Bee venom, rattlesnake venom, stuff like this. That doesn't mean it's a hallucinogenic drug. It means you're dying. And you should take steps to correct the situation. Now, yes?
You said that there was a short transit time, but how long does the memory of that experience last? Because that would indicate to me that there is still a presence, and perhaps a homeopathic dose at that point, in the mind, in the brain.
Well, DMT, one of the things that has caused me to think that it might have a role in the chemistry of dreaming is that one of the frustrating things about it is you have this experience, without doubt, the most bizarre, appalling, peculiar experience you could possibly have. That's at minute 2. At minute 5, you're raving about it. At minute 7, you can't remember it. And so it's literally like gold running through your fingers. You say, you know, this is the most amazing thing. This is the most amazing thing. This is, what am I talking about? And you know how you can have a very engaging, complex dream and the alarm goes off, and by the time your feet hit the floor, you're grasping for it. And it's literally melting before your eyes. That's a very DMT-like presentation. The way a dream melts away is the way a DMT trip melts away at the same speed. Well, over time and using tricks, you can drag a certain amount of data out of it. And what I'll do is I'll describe a DMT trip, and it's a composite of maybe 40 of these trips, and then you can see what you make of it. So this is, I'll just describe it. I'll be the graduate student. You be the guy with the clipboard. You're saying to me, so what happened? Okay, here's what happened. Most people can get off in about 3 to 4 hits. Now there's a trick to it. Hash smokers are greatly favored in this endeavor because you really need leather lungs for this. The great problem is that people will cough or not be able to hold it in. You take two hits in a situation where your clothes have been loosened and you can just flop backward when you need to. You take two hits. Now, many people miss the point because after two hits, you feel completely peculiar. You feel as though your body is undergoing some strange kind of anesthesia. All the air has been pumped out of the room. This is the visual acuity thing I talked about last night. The colors jump up. The edges sharpen. And at that point, people say, whoa, wow, it's really coming on strong. And then what you have to do is you have to take one more enormous hit. And this separates the intrepid from the casual, believe me. Because most people, and the facilitator doesn't want to lean on the person. You say, you know, damn it, take the third hit. And saying, no, I feel completely weird. Say, I know you feel weird, but take the third hit. Well, if you can coax somebody into that, then what happens is you close your eyes and you see the ordinary warm brown back, you know, closed eyelid scenario, and then these colors begin racing together and it forms this mandalic floral slowly rotating thing, which I call the chrysanthemum. This is a place in the trip that you want to see as you go by it. The chrysanthemum forms and you watch it for like 15 seconds. If it doesn't give way, then you didn't do enough. You have to do more. One more hit usually will do it. Well, then what happens is it like physically propels you through this chrysanthemum-like thing, and there's a sound like a saran wrap bread wrapper being crumpled up and thrown away, you know, that crackle. A friend of mine says, this is your radio intellecty leaving through the anterior fontanelle at the top of your head. I don't know what it is, but it's something is being... Yeah, right, that's what it is. And then there's this very defined sense of bursting through something, a membrane. And on the other side, and this is now, remember, my experience, on the other side, as you break through, there's a cheer. There's a whole bunch of entities waiting on the other side. And they, you know that Pink Floyd song, the gnomes have learned a new way to say hooray. Well, it's that place. It's those gnomes. And you burst into this space and they're saying, how wonderful that you're here. You come so rarely. We're so delighted to see you. And one of the things about DMT that's really puzzling is, in a sense, it doesn't affect your mind. In other words, you don't change. For instance, if you take ketamine, the first thing you notice, the very first thing you notice before the trip hits, is you notice that you no longer are anxious about having taken ketamine. You just sort of, anxiety leaves you. That means it's affecting your mind. It's doing something to the judgmental machinery. DMT doesn't lay a hand on the judgmental machinery. You break through into that space exactly who you were before breaking through. And the usual reaction of most people is something like, you know, and you think, God. Heartbeat, normal. Pulse, normal. Everything's normal. Yeah, everything's normal. Oh, God. Because these things are there, and they're hammering at you, and they come forward. They're like jeweled self-dribbling basketballs. And there are many of them. And they come pounding toward you, and they will stop in front of you and vibrate, but then they do a very disconcerting thing, which is they jump into your body. They jump into your body, and then they jump back out again. And the whole thing is going on in this very high-speed mode where you're being presented with thousands of details per second, and you can't get a hold on... You say, you know, my God, what's happening? And these things are saying, don't abandon yourself to amazement, which is exactly what you want to do. You just want to go nuts with how crazy this is. They say, don't do that. Don't do that. Pay attention. Pay attention to what we're doing. Well, what are they doing? Well, what they're doing is they're making objects with their voices. They're singing structures into existence. These things are, and what they will do is they'll come toward you, and then, and you have to understand, they don't have arms, so we're kind of downloading this into a lower dimension to even describe it. But what they do is they offer things to you. Say, look at this, look at this. And as your attention goes toward these objects, you realize that what you're being shown is impossible. It's impossible. It's not simply intricate, beautiful, and hard to manufacture. It's impossible to make these things. The nearest analogy would be to the Fabergé eggs or something like that. But these things are like the toys that are scattered around the nursery inside a UFO or something. Celestial toys. And they are, the toys themselves appear to be somehow alive. The toys themselves can sing other objects into existence. So what's happening is there's just this proliferation of elf gifts. And the elf gifts are moving around, singing, and the whole thing is directed toward, they're saying, do what we are doing. And they're very insistent. They say, do it, do it, do it. And you feel like a bubble, and now this is subjective. I mean, only a 5% report this, but it happens to me. You feel like some kind of bubble inside your body that's beginning to move up toward your mouth, and when it comes out, it isn't sound; it's vision. You begin to, you discover that you can pump stuff out of your mouth by singing, and they're urging you to do this. They say, that's it, keep doing it. And the whole thing is like, you know, we're now at minute 4.5 with this stuff, and you speak in a kind of glossolalia. There's a spontaneous outpouring of syntax unaccompanied by what is normally called meaning. It's sort of, you know, he ding wow wak saptivi muldektipi ting get qua haxiki pipin em wahavedektam bohaga getek. And this is accompanied by a modality, something seen. And they're saying, yes, do it, do it, do it. And then after a minute or so of this, the whole thing begins to collapse in on itself, and they literally begin to physically move away from you. And usually their final shot is they actually wave goodbye and they say, déjà vu, which makes no sense at all if you analyze it. So then you come down, and you're now at minute 6 to 7, and you come down, and it's like being more loaded than you've ever been. It's like about a 700 mic acid trip. But you embrace it as totally down. You say, I'm totally down. I mean, you look like a termite from Arcturus, and the room is decorated in Amish quilts, but I'm completely back. And then, over a minute or a minute and a half or so, the room just comes right back together. And 4 minutes after that, some people can give no account of it whatsoever. They just say, I don't know. It was the weirdest thing that ever happened to me, and I can't remember it now. So that's the basic run through. Now, a lot of stuff is going on in there. First of all, what are these things? And why do they want you to do this strange activity? And what's so great about it? Well, first of all, who are these things? We can, be good scientists and make a list of the possibilities and then see which seems more likely. They could be a disincarnate race of hyper-dimensional dwellers who live in some kind of parallel continuum just over some kind of energy barrier, and they're there all the time. You do have the feeling that they're there all the time, that it's ongoing, that you have just cut into their scene. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that behind all these psychedelics, and especially DMT, that this is not a drug at all. That it is essentially a pay telephone of some sort to aliens. Good old National Enquirer type aliens of who are using this as a communication domain. Say, we can't land on the White House lawn. That would create panic and hysteria. So let's create a drug, which inside the drug, we will be able to deal with people. And I was hoping that John Mack, who's an expert on UFO abductions, would be here this weekend. I expected him, because I think this whole abduction thing is not going to be illuminated until they start giving abductees DMT and saying, so is this what happened to you? Was it like this, or was it completely different? Well, so then those are the two possibilities that I sort of dealt with over the first 10 or 15 years of thinking about this. And then recently...
Yes. Just 1 second. So possibly that experience that people are interpreting as an abduction is just a hyperproduction of endogenous DMT within the brain.
It could be. What puzzles me is that the abduction thing is so non-psychedelic. It's so cut and dried. And all this anal examination stuff with strange machinery, there's nothing comparable to that, I'm happy to report to you, going on in the DMT thing. But it may be, you see... Well, I'd be interested in looking at the possibility that DMT under normal or abnormal conditions could be sequestered in the human brain, and then some unusual stimulus or stress could cause it to suddenly be dumped. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I want to share that there have been some migraines that I've had where, what you just described about the colors coming in and the chrysanthemums happened, and it's been so fascinating that I've completely forgotten about the pain about it and just watched it for hours. Well, until I guess I fell asleep, but it sort of struck a note, and I was always under a lot of stress when I got the headache in the first place, and there seemed to be a lot of brain things going on with the migraine in the first place. So I'm wondering if that...
Yeah, that's an interesting possibility. I also have migraines, or the kind called cluster headaches. And yes, a lot of the nice thing about DMT is that it's painless, but the sense of being split open and of the traveling scotomata, as they call these hallucinations that migraine people see, it's related in some way, yeah, yeah.
May I bring science into this a little bit?
Sure.
It involves a principle that is characterized or called phasing, but its basis is sort of what happens on a subatomic level between matter and energy. Turns out there's no fundamental particle. At that level, you have this dance between matter and energy. You know, energy coalesces into a bit of matter, which then becomes energy. And you can look at this matter-energy relationship as having a wavelength or frequency associated with it. Now, granted, this happens on a subatomic level, but if there's something comparable going on a level at which we seem to exist in the physical form, and it seems to me that there has to be something akin to it, that it may be that we as beings are sort of tuned to a frequency range, you know, in this particular form, and that somehow it's possible to shift that or expand it to so that what we're actually experiencing is a broader range of frequencies or sort of a shift in wavelength. And I think some of these experiences can be at least explored, you know, in that context. You know, there's so much that we don't know.
Ain't that the truth?
Of this cosmos that, but we can take, you know, we can extrapolate to some degree. At least we can use this to take journeys and explore possibilities from what we do know in science, for example, what happens on a subatomic or on a quantum level. I mean, for God's sake, the language of these people is sounding more like sorcerers these days than scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And we do seem to at least believe from the evidence that we see that there is this matter-energy interchange on a very fundamental level. Now, if something akin to that is going on a macro level, there may be this principle of phasing in which we either shift our tuning or we expand it to include a larger spectrum.
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting avenue to pursue, this thing about frequency. Somebody told me one of the great things about this job is you hear a lot of weird stories. And somebody told me a story recently about, it didn't involve DMT, it involved LSD, but this guy and a friend of his took a quite large dose of LSD, larger than they intended, and they went to a party. And they were so loaded by the time they got to the party that they realized they could not function as partygoers. So they just moved into a corner and sat with their backs to the wall and watched this party rage in front of them. And after about 20 minutes of sitting there, they both simultaneously noticed, it was a dance party, noticed that the music was sounding really strange, and everybody was moving very slowly. And as they watched, the thing came to an absolute halt, and people were just frozen, and there was absolute silence. And at that point, the door at the other end of the room swung open, and an elf entered the room and moved among all these frozen people and then left by the door he came in. And they both saw this, and they said that they could tell that it was that the people in the room didn't know it happened, because for them it occupied a microsecond. But this thing that was, you know, in Carlos Castaneda, who God knows is not the world's most reliable reporter on these things. Nevertheless, there is this thing about stopping the world. So maybe it's something like that, that there is, as you suggest, a frequency phase. Yeah. This sort of leads into the third possibility having to do with the origin of these things. And in a sense, this is the hardest one to swallow. But in another sense, this is the most conservative, in some crazy notion of conservative, the most conservative explanation. Because, yeah. Because we have no evidence other than the tabloids, that this world is being visited by friendly visitors from Zenebel-Ganubi or Zeta Reticuli or the Pleiades or anywhere else. I mean, to my mind, the evidence that this is happening is vanishingly small and totally underwhelming. The other possibility, there's some kind of parallel dimension in which these things exist, is also somewhat poorly supported. If we're talking about something which thinks, something which can communicate, something which is intelligent, then we should look to ourselves as the source of it, because we are the only intelligent communicating things we know within a certain narrow definition of these things. So that it's occurred to me with greater and greater force, and largely prompted by giving DMT occasionally to Tibetans and Amazonian shamans. And when you say to them, you know, to the shamans in the Amazon, when you say to them, what is happening with this stuff, and what are those little things in there? They say, oh, well, those are ancestor spirits. Didn't you know? Haven't you heard? Shamanism is about doing healing through the intercession of ancestor spirits. Say, ancestor spirits, let's get this straight. Dead people is what you're talking about, right? These are dead people. And, you know, maybe because I was raised Catholic, I resisted this like grim death. But I'm beginning to think that what you actually break into in that place is something that we might call an ecology of souls. That is it possible to entertain the notion that at death you actually don't just become worm food, but that something survives in some other dimension, and that it has this bizarre character to it, and that this explains their peculiar affection for humanity and their involvement somehow in our fate. Well, this is, to me, fairly mind-bending as a possibility. If what is awaiting us at the end of the 20th century is the erasure of the boundary between the living and the dead, then we've all been too conservative in our projections of what is going on. Yeah.
Isn't that one of the aspects of the returning of the Messiah, the digital
line? Yes, that there will be some kind of erasure of the boundary between the two. Well, once I had this idea, you know, I mentioned my Jungian and art historical proclivities, and so that means you always look back through tradition and folklore to try and find something analogous to this. Well, there ain't much, but there is one area that seems suggestive to me, and that is, as you all know, the Irish are a fairy-haunted race. They're also an intoxication-obsessed race, at least in stereotype. Well, it turns out that you probably all are familiar with the notion of purgatory. Purgatory is the place where you have to spend a lot of time before you get to heaven if you're not bad enough to go to hell. So you put in a few calculiochasms of eternity in purgatory, and then you get let into heaven. Well, I had always assumed that this dogma, I don't know, I hadn't really thought about it. I just sort of assumed it arose with early Christianity. But when I began looking into this, I discovered that the idea of purgatory was invented by Saint Patrick. And it was invented specifically to convert the pagan Irish, because the pagan Irish believed in the land of Fae. They believed there was this nearby dimension full of the souls of the dead surrounding us all the time, and that certain people with the gift of second sight could see this. So Patrick just said to them, no, that isn't it. It's purgatory, and was able to push that on them so successfully that a later church council adopted it as general dogma for the church to use in converting the pagan Slavs as well. So it's an idea of a nearby dimension inhabited by disincarnate souls that is apparently very old, but very alien to our tradition. Yeah.
There is another notion that comes from quantum physics. I mean, it's going to be a gross oversimplification, but it's kind of related. And it has to do with the quantum wave function, which is really kind of a dual wave. It has two parts to it. One part, and they both have a temporal or time-related aspect to them. One part, which is called the ordinary part of the wave, can be seen as a wave propagating forward in time. And the other half of the wave, which is called the complex conjugate, can be seen as propagating backward in time from some future state, some past state, some future state, emitting waves which at some point interact and produce what is perceived or experienced as the present state, which is really a dynamic process in itself. There is no absolute present, because as soon as you get out of your mouth, it's past. But the interesting thing is that what that implies is that what we experience in the present, whatever they may be, is somehow related to some future state and some past state. But it also means that neither future or past are fixed, and that we could sort of align ourselves with different tracks or vectors, you know, and a slightly different vector, a slightly askew, may produce something totally different than what our ordinary perception is feeding.
Well, yeah, this could be. I mean, I've always felt that what biology is some weird kind of chemical strategy for amplifying quantum mechanical indeterminacy. That, you know, macrophysical objects are not subject to quantum mechanical indeterminacy, but organisms apparently are, especially thinking organisms.
We don't know. I mean, that's our perception. Our perception is that objects on a macro scale, large scale, are not subject to quantum
fluctuations.
But that's only because of this probability wave in some sense, in that if there's a most probable state, and if we happen to exist in that, that our perception is that it's more fixed, that there is no indeterminacy, it obeys certain laws that are rather linear in nature. But we really don't know.
What you're sort of saying is that natural laws only apply some of the time, which gives them a curious status as laws in that case.
Well, that's sort of broadening the notion of relativity. I mean, what happens in a black hole, for example? What is a singularity? It simply means that the laws that normally apply in everyday experience no longer are relevant.
Well, one of the problems cosmology is meeting is that there are so many large black holes in the universe that you come up with, you know, 10 high 6 singularities. That's a few more singularities than a good theory would tolerate, I would think. I mean, what kind of theory is it that hands you back 10 to the 9th singularities, which are exceptions to the theory?
That's true, but we, you know, a lot of that's based on assumptions that are stretches.
Ain't that the truth?
Language, again, it gets back to a psychedelic experience. You know, it's this whole lower dimensional language slice thing that we seem to have to operate in order to describe an experience that just does not fit into that slice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do our best to do it, you know, and sometimes it comes across being very crude and naive. Sometimes we kind of get close to the mark, but it's difficult to know. I mean, the whole notion of black hole singularities is just the present attempt at explaining some experience that is beyond ordinary experience. I mean, none of us have encountered a black hole directly that we know of, at least in this.
That's true. It seems to me one of the embarrassments of science is that the Big Bang begins with a singularity. And so then you have this whole vast interlocking schema of rational explanation, except that it begins with a hard swallow. You're asked to believe that the entire cosmos of space and time sprang from a point no larger than a cross section of a gnat's eyelash. Whatever else one could say about that theory, I think you'd agree it's the limit case for credulity.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you believe that, try to think of something that you would throw up your hands and say, well, I'm not buying that. It's sort of like when you join the Catholic Church, you make a declaration of faith. Well, when you join science, you sort of make this declaration of faith that I do believe that the universe sprang in a single instant from an incredibly tiny, hot, dense dot. Unlikely, but who knows?
There's something else. As you two were dialoguing a bit, I was getting this visualization of you have to look at the pond of reality, so to speak, as not only being the visual of someone throwing a pebble from the top of the pond and creating the ripple effect or the wave effect, but also from the bubbles coming from below. And to me, the deep space that you were talking about is the air inside the bubble coming from below. And so the dimensional reality of that picture is not a linear time perspective. It's something coming from all directions. It is, again, the center of the mandala effect.
Well, this is why I say the psychedelic experience is a boundary-dissolving experience, right? Because it takes away past, present, cause, effect. All of these things disappear. Now remember I said ayahuasca is a kind of slow release DMT trip. And one of the really interesting things going on with ayahuasca, to my mind perhaps the most interesting thing, is that the style in the Amazon of taking ayahuasca is people get together in a darkened hut at night and they take it and they sing. But the songs, they're selling them at the table back there. The songs, when there's a break in the singing and you hear the people discussing the songs, they don't discuss them like music. They discuss them like sculpture and painting. And they say to the shaman, I liked the part with the gray bars and the blue speckling. But when you brought in the pink in combination with the beige and white, I thought it was too much. Say, what kind of a discussion is this about a song? You realize then when you take ayahuasca, they see the songs. And now this is really interesting to me because you remember in the DMT flash, they wanted you to use your voice to make objects. Well, then in the ayahuasca trance, you use your voice to control these colored modalities. And the whole thing is done that way. Well, so then what it must mean is that the neurophysiology of ayahuasca somehow allows for the ordinary signal processing, which is being shunted into the audio pathway in the brain, is instead being shunted into the optical pathway. This is what's called a synesthesia. These things have been fascinating for hundreds of years to people. But the synesthesia means that, you know, color, sounds are seen. Well, now, is this anything other than a neurophysiological curiosity? Well, I maintain it is, because I think that a language which could be seen would be a kind of telepathic language. If you've thought much about telepathy, you might have naively assumed that telepathy is you hearing me think. That isn't what it is, I think. Telepathy is you seeing what I mean. And it's not something which happens dramatically. It is a function of eloquence. You know, first you have the speaker who is boring you to death. Then you have the speaker who at least holds your attention. Then you have the speaker of whom it is said, she paints a picture. It means we're moving toward poetry. Well, it's possible to imagine a transformation of the neural processing of language. It may be a behavioral possibility. It may not even require a gene shift, where then we would see what we each mean. You know, there's this persistent idea promulgated by Robert Graves in The White Goddess, among other people, that there was once what he calls an Ursprach, a primal language, so emotionally intense that to be in the presence of poetry declaimed in this language is to see the poetry, and that this is what the lost poetics of the High Paleolithic were about. And probably it was pharmacologically assisted, that you could gather people in the presence of a great bard or singer, and that person could then create telepathic modalities. And that telepathic modality, that richer, more unifying language, was the thing which was suppressing the formation of ego. The ego speaks and hears through sound. The superego projects images and is perceived as images. Now, it's very interesting, at least to me, that in the pineal gland of ordinary human beings, there is a compound called adenoglomerotropine, which, when analyzed in inorganic, or just in the normal nomenclature of organic chemistry, turns out to be a beta-carboline closely related to harmaline. Well, is it possible that we are as close as a one-gene mutation away from a shift that would switch our processing of audio input into the visual field, and that then we would cross over into a realm of beheld understanding, and that this is the evolutionary leap that we're trying to make, that it's in the body, not in the technology. In the body, there is actually going to be a one gene click to another channel, and then we will be able to see what we mean. And I maintain that if you can see what somebody means, you are that person. Contrast it to ordinary communication. Ordinary communication is achieved through small mouth noises. As primates, we have a throat and voice box arrangement that allows us to produce small mouth noises for hours if necessary. I'm the living proof of it. But it's not a very efficient mode of communication, because what happens is I have a thought. I look in a culturally sanctioned dictionary, which I have copied into my head. I translate the thought into an acoustical signal using my mouth, which moves across space, which enters your ears. You rush to your interior dictionary, and you construct my meaning out of your dictionary. Now notice that this process rests on a very shaky assumption. It rests on the assumption that your dictionary and my dictionary were published by the same folks in the same year. If your dictionary is different from mine, you will not correctly reconstruct my meaning, and we will have what we call misunderstanding. Notice how among us as a species, one of the most bring down things you can say to somebody is, would you please explain to me what I just said? Because it means, oh boy, here comes trouble. Now you're going to find out that, you know, people didn't understand you. They horribly misunderstood, and the communication is very provisional. The amount of noise in the circuit is huge. Well, then contrast this to I utter something, and it condenses as a sculpture in the air, and you and I then become its observers, and we rotate this syntactical object, and we look at it, we regard it from many points of view. This is not ambiguous. Or it's certainly considerably less ambiguous than this reconstruction from interiorized dictionaries. So perhaps what all this is about is evolutionary pressure on our languages to become visual and therefore to become more unified and less riddled with noise, which creates misunderstanding, which creates horrible social realities. Yeah.
I'm just in the middle of reading a book called Holographic Universe.
Oh, Michael Talbot's book. Uh-huh.
He was talking about visual experience of things about 50% based on meaning and addition internally to you know, what's coming through visually. So it sounds like you still have a transmission problem, a translation issue.
Yes, although what you could do with a visible language would be very challenging. I mean, we could do many things with it. It's not an outlandish, it's not a completely outlandish idea. In nature, it occurs. There's a wonderful phenomenon in nature, which is worth talking about to sort of legitimate such a far-out notion, which is, as you all probably know, octopi can change color. This is one of those things you learn on those science specials on TV.